Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. Today I'm your host, Carl Nellis, and we are talking with Molly Worthen, Assistant Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're talking about her new book, Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism, out from University of Oxford Press in 2014. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we always like to start with hearing a little bit about the person behind the book. Can we hear a little bit about what brought you to this project, how you got interested in the history of evangelicalism, how you got interested in the past 100 years as opposed to all of history that's open to us?
Sure. Well, I grew up outside of Chicago, about 20 miles west of the city in a town called Glen Ellen, which happens to be just a couple of miles. My childhood home was just a couple of miles from one of the American evangelical meccas, Wheaton College, which I ended up writing an awful lot about in this book. But I myself did not grow up in an evangelical family. I knew Wheaton College rather vaguely as this place where my parents said they didn't allow dancing, and it was kind of mysterious to me. So I really had no particular interest in religion. If anything, I was resentful of my parents' few hesitant attempts to teach my brother and me about religion, about Christian ideas, until I got to university, where as a student in history classes, I began to realize that religion is the framework through which a huge proportion of human beings today and throughout the history of the human race have processed the world. And so if I wanted to understand history, I had to understand religion. At that time, my main interests were not American religion, really at all. I was particularly interested in Russian Orthodoxy. I spent really most of my undergraduate time studying Russian history, taking a lot of Russian language. I took Old Church Slavic. I was quite committed to it. I spent a summer doing what I would now call amateur ethnography in rural northern Alberta with a small community of Russian Orthodox old believers, which I suppose you could somewhat inaccurately caricature as the Russian version of the Amish. And that I think was a formative experience for me. It's where I really I couldn't embed in this community because they are too resistant to outsiders. But I certainly got the closest I'd ever gotten to really having a full orbed understanding of a religious community, very unlike any that I had grown up around. I took a bit of a detour into diplomatic history, and my first book, which grew out of a project I began as an undergraduate, is actually a biography of a Foreign Service officer and who I came to know because he became a professor at Yale, where I did my undergraduate work and my PhD. And that, I suppose, it took me into the broad history of the second half of the 20th century from an international perspective and the history of ideas as my subject encountered them. But along the way, I'd also maintained an interest in journalism. I had done some internships at a couple of newspapers. I interned at Time magazine after college, wrote for my college paper. And when it came time to decide what to do next, I wanted to be a religion writer. But I thought that as someone with this somewhat odd, spotty background in Russian religion, I didn't really have any qualifications that would enable me to bring some real value to American journalism. I thought, well, I need to spend some time reading a lot of books, studying the history, acquainting myself with the scriptures, all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And also, frankly, I wasn't all that eager to leave the university, you know, idol, the wonderful, you know, ivory tower, you know, kind of isolation from some of the pressures of grown-up jobs. So I applied to graduate school. I ended up staying at Yale. And really initially for strategic reasons, I chose to specialize in contemporary American Christianity. I would have been very happy to continue my study of Russian Orthodoxy. I've always been a closet medievalist. I would have been very happy to focus on, you know, 14th century Carthusian monks or something. But I was thinking, well, what can I sell magazine articles about, you know, to editors? There isn't a huge, unfortunately, it is greatly unfortunate. There's not a huge market for articles on medieval monasticism. Mm-hmm. So, but I thought, you know, this is not going to work if my interest in this subject is purely strategic. This is just sort of something I'll try out and I may change, as so many graduate students do. But it turns out, I quickly discovered that to understand anything about the 20th century, you have to do your homework all the way back. Mm-hmm. So I was able to indulge my interests, I guess you could say, in ancient and medieval and early modern history. And along the way, I continued to freelance. I wrote magazine articles now and then about contemporary American evangelicalism and religion and politics, the Christian right, this sort of thing. And by the end of it, I began graduate school in 2005. I was finishing my PhD in 2011. It seemed to me that the bottom had really fallen out from journalism as a profession. And I was rather risk averse to begin with. That's half the reason I went to graduate school. So I couldn't see trying to make it as a freelancer in that economic climate. And in the meanwhile, I think I had simply become spoiled by the wonderful resources of a university community. And I loved not only doing academic work, but also doing journalism in the context of a great library and lots of experts to talk to. Mm-hmm. So I decided to continue my journalistic work along the side, but really focus on, I guess, what you'd call a more traditional academic career. And so here I am teaching history at the University of North Carolina.
Can you tease out the genesis of the book from the end of that story, I guess?
I was broadly interested in American evangelicals and the history of the Christian right, and I had this sense that ideas, that intellectual history was a more important component of the rise of the Christian right than many narratives make apparent. Mm-hmm. I also, as I was sort of reading my way through the many, many books that exist on the history of evangelicals, it struck me that a huge proportion of them are written by historians who come themselves from the evangelical world, and not just that, but come from a particular corner of it. They tend to be evangelicals from the Reformed corner of Protestantism. So the broad stream of the Reformation that, you know, takes its cues, at least in a general sense, from John Calvin and Huldrych Zwingli and those guys, and is associated with a particularly cerebral version of Protestantism, one that's quite focused on doctrine, one that's quite focused on reforming culture and has a high view of the power of God and what that means for predestination and the direction of our lives. But there are a huge range of slightly or quite profoundly different approaches to the Protestant tradition that make up evangelicalism, as I understand it, ranging from the Anabaptist tradition to the Pentecostals. So I set out very much with the aim of trying to incorporate voices from those traditions into an account of the Christian right. So my aim, as you can tell, was very general. I'm sort of amazed looking back that my professors signed off on it because I really had no particular plan. And as I got into the archives, I came to discover the reasons why the different branches of the evangelical community have the relationships with one another that they do. And so I would say that three major arguments emerged in the book that I ended up writing. The first I've mentioned, and that is that the culture wars, as we understand them, the rise of the Christian right, they have an intellectual backstory that you cannot simply point to, the anti-communist movement and backlash against the civil rights movement and kind of racial prejudice dressed up as theology. Those are all useful angles on the story, but they are limited, and that to have a more complete understanding of the past 50 years of American politics, you need to get into ideas. Secondly, I arrived at, I guess, a broader definition of what the heck an evangelical is than I'd encountered in a lot of scholarship or conversations with people who study these things. I suppose the pattern on this much debated issue, because people, both scholars and Christians, observant Christians alike, have been kind of arguing over what evangelical means for a very long time. Yeah. But I would say the tendency is for people to define the term by looking to doctrine, by trying to come up with sort of a statement of faith that all evangelicals share. And I found those definitions useful and so as far as they go, but even points of doctrine that are often suggested as the sine qua non of what evangelicalism is, like the born again experience, you know, this kind of emotional, often kind of instantaneous experience, subjective experience that persuades someone to accept Christ as their Lord and Savior. I mean, once you really start poking at that and asking a Pentecostal what he means by that, asking a Mennonite what she means by that idea, you start to see that it's not as unifying as you might think. So I ended up circling instead around three questions that I think have defined the evangelical tradition since the Reformation. I began to think of evangelicalism not as a unified movement, but it was really a conversation of churches and communities that orbit around these shared concerns. And those are, number one, how do you meet Jesus? How do you attain assurance of your salvation and cultivate an authentic relationship with your God? Secondly, how do you reconcile faith and reason? And third, how do you live out your personal faith in this increasingly secular public square? And so I really, as those three questions suggest, I really came to see evangelicalism as a Western child of the Enlightenment. I mean, as a modern phenomenon. And we might use the term evangelical to talk about Christians in the global South, but if we do that, I think we need to be very clear about what we mean about the very different historical contexts.
Right.
The third argument that I arrived at as I worked my way through archives around the country at various denominations and evangelical colleges and universities was that there's a reason why in the history of evangelicalism, this one tradition, the Reformed tradition, seems to loom so large, and that in fact a particular rather small network of kind of post-fundamentalist Reformed evangelical intellectuals and evangelists exerted disproportionate influence over the political engagement of a much broader range of American evangelicals. About they influenced the way these other traditions began to talk about culture and think about politics. And in fact, despite lots of dissent and, you know, incredible diversity among evangelicals, a few of them, more conservative cousins of Billy Graham, I mean, people like Francis Schaeffer or Jerry Falwell, came to be anointed. They anointed themselves, I should say, and this was accepted, I think, by the mainstream media as the spokesman of what's actually a very diverse movement with all kinds of, including all kinds of folks who rejected these spokespeople. So my book tries to tell this story, starting really in the context of World War II and the emergence of this kind of new generation of evangelical intellectuals and ranging over these various traditions and how they engaged with some of the international religious trends of the late 20th century, taking it all the way up to our present time.
So let's jump in there where you start your history in the book and talk about the idea of worldview or Weltanschauung and the fundamentalist modernist controversy from which some of these evangelical thinkers emerge.
I start the book writing about the circle of intellectuals and preachers that I guess you could say orbited around Billy Graham. I mean, he's a useful place to anchor ourselves because, you know, even if you haven't studied this stuff, you know who Billy Graham is.
Right.
And they generally had kind of grown up in the generation after the generation that really fought the most hammer and tongs, violent fights, theological fights in the fundamentalist modernist battles of the early 20th century. So these individuals, people like Carl Henry, who was a journalist from Long Island, and Harold Lindzell, who all kind of came together along with Billy Graham to found institutions like the magazine Christianity Today. They had grown up in the wake of the fundamentalist modernist fights and what those fights had done to the intellectual reputation of traditional Protestantism. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the shadow of the Scopes trial is sort of hanging over all of this. And these guys really were not happy with the way in which evangelicals, Orthodox Protestants, as they saw them, had been cast, you know, by people like H.L. Mencken as mm-hmm. as these ignorant bumpkins who were behind the times, whose theology was so much less sophisticated than the theology coming out of, you know, German universities and that sort of thing. So they set out on a mission to both rehabilitate the intellectual reputation of their tradition mm-hmm. and also find a way to kind of supersede all the what they thought were the negative, unfortunate aspects of the fundamentalist movement. They didn't like the way the fundamentalist movement really took this militant posture toward culture, advocated, you know, the creating a separate, pure Christian world unto itself. Mm-hmm. These guys were really in favor of more active engagement with the elements of Western culture they didn't agree with. And so one of their number, a Boston pastor named Harold Akinyay, coined the term neo-evangelical to describe what they were about. You know, neo meaning we're kind of reinventing this tradition, but we're sticking very closely to all the theological fundamentals. Theologically, these guys really saw themselves as still fundamentalists, but in their style, in their engagement with intellectual opponents, they were something new. They were evangelicals. And so they founded a number of institutions to try to advance this perspective, this magazine, Christianity Today, a new society for evangelical theologians, a new seminary out in California, Fuller Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about their background is that a number of them went to some of the same higher educational institutions, places like Wheaton College in my childhood backyard, and Westminster Theological Seminary, a conservative Presbyterian school, and they had studied in many cases with the same professors. And so they all had direct contact with a particular theological tradition called presuppositionalism. And that's a real mouthful. But really, the key ideas of it are right there in that word. Presuppositionalism is an approach to theology, to argument, that says the most important thing is a person's presuppositions. That is, the assumptions that you or I bring to our conversation that we don't really challenge, that maybe we're not totally aware of, but that inform our starting point and inform what we can believe or not believe. And this is an approach to theological debate that really has its roots in the late 19th century, the turn of the century in the Netherlands. A thinker named Abraham Kuyper, who became important for these guys, but the fellow who really brought it into its mature form was a professor that a number of my subjects had at Westminster Theological Seminary, a Dutch guy named Cornelius van Til, and he really hammered out the details of this, and so my subjects were really preoccupied with one of the key ideas in presuppositionalism, which is the notion of the worldview, the Weltanschauung. You used the German word earlier, which is so evocative, I think. And and it really had a wider resonance at this point in Western history, because that German word was familiar to a quite wide range of American English-speaking readers, even outside the realm of theology and the ivory towers of the universities, because of World War II, and because it was a word that Adolf Hitler had frequently used in his speeches. He had defended the Nazi Weltanschauung, and he had torn down and, you know, tried to discredit what he saw as the bankruptcy of the Western Weltanschauung. And in the 1930s and 40s, there was a great deal of angst among Western intellectuals, and I'm not just speaking of conservative Christians here. about the Western worldview and the moral roots, and at a time when it did seem, I think, to many intellectuals, like Christianity's role in Western culture had really evolved or even eroded. This is a story, not of a bunch of intellectuals kind of playing catch up, playing intellectual catch up, being kind of behind the times, belatedly grasping old ideas, but rather it's a story of these Christian thinkers who are really in the thick of World War II and the early Cold War, because of course the Weltanschauung battle, of the 50s and forward was the Cold War. And they elaborated this notion of the Christian worldview into a really powerful political and cultural tool. I mean, their argument was, if you are a true Christian, Christianity is then not just something that you do on Sundays or maybe Wednesday evenings too. It's not just something that you do in your own home at your dinner table. It has to inform every sphere of your existence, from the schools you send your children to how you vote, to how you, think about, the relations between husbands and wives, mm-hmm. to your views on international relations and economics. And while this first generation of intellectuals that I was interested in were not super savvy political organizers, their interests, to be fair, were not really in direct political grassroots organizing. Their interests were more intellectual and cultural. I believe that in many ways they laid the groundwork for just a very powerful orientation that we can trace across the decades and find still today among Christian right activists.
Mm-hmm. Some of the people that you've already mentioned become names, they're not Billy Graham, but they become names that recur over and over even as your narrative goes forward. You talk about Carl Henry, and you've mentioned him already. But there are some other figures who come back and back over the next few decades of your narrative. And one of them is John Howard Yoder. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Yes. Well, here I set out in this project to overturn the dominance of this particular group of reformed thinkers. And, mm-hmm. and I've just spent several minutes talking about them, and they did remain, I couldn't get away from them. They just, they remain so important, but I stuck to my original mission of really trying to pay close attention to these other kinds of evangelicals. And I deliberately defined evangelical and my net, my archival net, wider than some people would. Our Mennonites, and John Howard Yoder was one of the most prominent Mennonite theologians of the 20th century. Are they evangelicals? Well, if you put that question to Mennonites themselves, you'd get a range of answers. Many, many Mennonites would say, absolutely not. We don't want anything to do with that word. But Mennonites are a great example of a community that, even if a lot of them are uncomfortable identifying as evangelical, largely because of the political connotations that word now has, they pay attention to evangelical conversations and happenings, and they care about what's going on in that conversation that I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. So Yoder is a great example. He is someone who he grew up in the thick of Mennonite culture in Indiana, and was very intellectually inclined from the beginning, headed off to Europe to continue his studies, and struck up as a young man a very interesting set of correspondence with some of the guys that I've been talking about, these kind of reformed post-fundamentalist folks, including Carl Henry, mm-hmm. who was quite a bit older than him, but Yoder was precocious and never short on, self-confidence. So he wrote Henry a number of letters, basically picking an argument with him about the nature of evangelicalism and the mission of traditional Protestantism in the 20th century. And I was really struck when I was reading these letters in his archival collection in Goshen, Indiana, that he always uses the first person plural. He says, we, this is a matter that we need to take seriously, not you as an evangelical, but we as evangelicals.
Right.
And he really, even as a young man, challenged some key assumptions that evangelicals like Carl Henry had about the authority of the Bible and the role of Christians in culture. So, you know, Anabaptists have a different way of understanding biblical authority. These Reformed guys who orbited around Billy Graham really put at the kind of center of their Christian worldview a particular understanding of the Bible's perfection, this idea of biblical inerrancy, the notion that the Bible is wholly without error, not just in matters pertaining to salvation, but in every detail of history and science, you know, from the scope of the flood to the, you know, the minute details of ancient Israel's politics. Essentially, the Bible, you know, the Bible is a textbook. And this is a view with a particular history we can talk about maybe later on if you're interested, that goes back to the 17th century, I would say. And it has to do with the way that the forebears of Carl Henry, Protestant theologians, tried to push back against their opponents in the scientific revolution and Enlightenment thinkers, as well as Catholic Counter-Reformation theologians who had this inconvenient habit of logically, mercilessly picking apart Protestant arguments. So they developed, in response to these threats, Carl Henry's theological ancestors tried to essentially turn their enemies' weapons upon them, and they developed a highly rationalistic mode of considering the Bible that really took as its founding assumption, if God is perfect and unchanging, then his revelation must be perfect and unchanging as well. And what that means is that every detail of Scripture is absolutely without error. And if modern science ever seems to be at odds with some part of Scripture, then it is modern science that is wrong. Now, you can see how this sets this stream of evangelicalism up for a real collision with much of modern intellectual life. John Howard Yoder was very aware that this fundamentalist view of the Bible had made some inroads in the Mennonite community. Mennonites had their own version of the fundamentalist modernist fight. And this is an early sign of what I mean about the influence of this particular stream, this Reformed stream of evangelicalism. But Yoder felt that this was not actually true to the whole spirit of the Anabaptist heritage. And, you know, the Anabaptist tradition is historically not so fixated or inclined to view the Bible as a history textbook, but rather to focus on the Bible as a guide for daily life and communal responsibility. There's a lot of emphasis in the Mennonite tradition, particularly on really what the Bible means for our life together as a community and how you should conduct yourself on a daily basis. And there's not a highly developed doctrine of biblical inspiration. You know, did God really dictate every word? You know, what was the relationship between the authors of Scripture and God? This is not a question historically that really bothered Mennonites. I mean, you know, for their early history, they were busy, you know, running away from various, you know, czars and potentates who wanted to persecute them. So they had other things on their mind. And so Yoder, in addition, of course, Yoder drew on the Anabaptist testimony of nonviolence and a very different understanding of what it means to witness to the gospel in a hostile culture. And so he was drawing on this tradition to really push back against the influence of the other wing of evangelicalism represented by Carl Henry and his associates. And that's a tension that I trace, you know, all the way up through the present day as we see, you know, in our own time, young millennial evangelicals who perhaps grew up in mega churches that are connected to that Billy Graham, Carl Henry tradition, but are now rather frustrated with the legacy of the moral majority, with that approach to the culture wars. And you find them picking up the books of John Howard Yoder and really getting interested in this different way of thinking about Christian heritage.
The other groups that you spend significant time on, I think justly, are the Wesleyan traditions, the Nazarene Church and the Methodist Church. And in particular, you draw them into the narrative when you're talking about setting up educational institutions, looking at the evangelical colleges, Bible colleges, seminaries, putting them side by side with colleges like Goshen and Nazarene schools. Can you talk a little bit more and maybe kind of move forward in your argument, talking about the significance of higher education and the role that it played in this emerging evangelical identity?
Yeah, I think that conservative Protestants, all since the very beginning of their history on the North American continent, saw themselves as responsible for the education of the next generation. And, you know, for a very long time, up into the late 19th century, you know, for the small proportion of Americans who went to college, they most of them would have gone to church-affiliated institutions, mm-hmm. small liberal arts colleges, often founded by denominations or missionary groups. And in this model of education, the point of higher education is to make a responsible Christian citizen and pass down a certain Christian Western heritage, sense of duty, and respect for one's elders and authority. Professors were not specialists who had really much interest in making new discoveries, but rather they tended to be generalists, often young men who were on their way to something else, who were really passing along this general body of knowledge. The president of these places was typically a pastor himself, and he would often teach a capstone course called moral philosophy, which, you know, would be this kind of blend of, you know, normative claims about the world drawing on Christianity and the Western philosophical tradition. Mm-hmm. And what happens in the late 19th century is that America begins to import a very different model of higher education based on the research universities that emerged in Germany. Mm-hmm. These institutions were generally, at some level, quite independent from church authority, with a great deal of emphasis on a long education of deep specialization for this emerging guild of academics who saw themselves as beholden not to any religious authority, but really only to other specialists in their field. Mm-hmm. And the point of universities in this paradigm is the advance of knowledge and the deliberate challenging of authority. Mm-hmm. And yeah. It's in these German universities that that we see the rise of higher biblical criticism that dares to really treat the Bible as a historical artifact, just like any other artifact. And this leads to all these theological reinterpretations and innovations that so disturb conservative Protestants. I start with this long prologue because it's important for understanding what 20th century evangelicals thought they were doing in their own efforts. They saw themselves as, I think, in many ways, trying to preserve the proper way education had happened, for the first couple of centuries of America's existence as a lively, you know, Christian Western colony and right. then a republic. And this takes on a new edge in the context of the late 19th, early 20th century, as evangelical groups become quite alarmed at the inroads that liberal Protestants are making in Christian education and in the culture more broadly. And so mm-hmm. we start to see some of these groups try to push back by founding their own institutions. And the story is different, you know, across the different traditions that I wrote about. I mean, I found with some of these churches, like the Church of the Nazarene and the Mennonites, number one, they had a pretty significant suspicion of the value of higher education mm-hmm. to begin with, particularly when it came to training pastors. They thought, well, you know, what seems to happen is you send young people away to university and they get exposed to these heterodox, you know, German ideas, and they come back and they're not fit to pastor a church. So what's the point of this? You know, really all you need to know to be a pastor is the Bible. I mean, the Mennonites, for crying out loud. I mean, they historically had selected pastors by lot, you know, it was a random process. So, but gradually, I think, because none of these groups are, you know, isolated from the American mainstream, and their own young people in increasing numbers, especially after World War II, are clamoring for higher educational opportunities, they begin to, you know, try to create this delicate balance between their duties to their own immediate theological community and their, you know, their need to respond to the trends in mainstream higher education. I never would have expected to become fascinated by rather abstruse arguments over college accreditation.
Right.
But I became totally fascinated. By accident, when I was out at Biola, which was a fundamentalist, now we'd probably say conservative evangelical school in Southern California, I stumbled upon the archive of this accreditation association that a number of fundamentalist Bible colleges got together and set up in the 1940s. And they did this because they saw that there was this increasing demand by various constituencies that they were answerable to, parents and students particularly, for some level of systemization. They had students who wanted to be able to transfer, you know, take their credits from their institution and go elsewhere. And they were aware that secular or liberal Protestant colleges had been accepting the authority of these regional accreditation bodies for some time. And they didn't want anything to do with that. But I thought, well, we can found our own. We can be in charge of our own rules. And also, and this was another interesting piece of it, we can control what it really means to be a Bible college, because we don't want our brand to be tarnished by, you know, non-serious places that aren't really teaching a rigorous, you know, education, biblical education, that really preparing students to be missionaries. So we want to control our turf. So what emerges is this sort of fascinating dance between this need to somehow keep pace with some of the demands in mainstream secular accreditation, especially as their students grow in number and are no longer so certain that they want to go on and serve the church their whole lives or become missionaries. You know, maybe they want to go to nursing school or law school or something that, you know, means they might want to take their degree and need it recognized by the state university up the road. Well, that means that these institutions have to start paying attention to what these mainstream accreditors want. They have to start building science labs and expanding their library while yet, you know, fending off the concerns of local pastors and alumni that they're somehow drifting from the Bible. You know, can they still insist on 30 hours of Bible course credits if students also have to do these other things? And I noticed, you know, as I traced this story down the decades, some kind of, you know, splits forks in the road, you know. So you have institutions like Moody Bible Institute, which was founded in the late 19th century. And, you know, really as a place where you would go and study English Bible, you would not really take Bible courses in the original languages, because that's the sort of thing that those German universities do, and it comes to no good. You would learn maybe basic dentistry, you know, so that you could go into, you know, the African bush, and you could take care of your family and the community you were evangelizing. Very practical courses like this.
Yeah.
And Moody Bible Institute today, while there have been interesting changes in their curriculum and a kind of multicultural awareness that you can really see in their course catalog now, it's still a Bible institute. I mean, it's still really aimed at young people who want to serve the church. But a place like Biola, whose name, you know, originally was an acronym for the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, which shares some, you know, very broadly speaking, some of the same DNA as Moody, has now become, you know, a large university and really sees itself as a cosmopolitan place. It has an honors college. It's a, you know, pretty serious operation. You can study, you know, a huge range of courses there.
Yeah.
And really, you know, has positioned itself while still adhering to conservative doctrines, you know, in a kind of marginal way, you know, really in a serious relationship with the mainstream expectations of secular intellectual life, I think. And so there's this paradox, you know, this way in which evangelical educators and administrators begin to value many of the things that mainstream intellectual life prizes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're often very proud of their faculty who have fancy PhDs, and that becomes more and more common as time passes. So there's a balance between that and the way in which they very much hold secular universities and everything they represent at arm's length and remain very critical of their authority, certainly very resistant on matters like the teaching of science and evolution, and as well, of course, as the study of the Bible and rules governing student life. All of these things remain important divisions. So in the book, I try to kind of tease out this paradox and try to make sense of it.
And in thinking about the way that some streams of evangelicalism engaged European thought, you coalesce it really interestingly into some engagements with Karl Barth, whom I think you call the most significant Protestant theologian of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And on the other side, with C.S. Lewis, who's a figure that you use to introduce the idea of imagination, which then comes back at the end of the book. Could you talk just a little bit more about those two figures and how American evangelicals related to them in the 60s, 70s?
I began my description of the neo-evangelicals by talking about their hunger for the intellectual respect that they thought they were due. And a major component of that was that they believed that they deserved a place at the table in this theological discussion really centered in Europe, I think. Mm-hmm. And they wanted someone like Karl Barth to take their theologians seriously. And so Christianity Today would review Karl Barth's books, would sometimes print excerpts from his books. There are very few, a handful of letters that the editors wrote to him, and I think I found one or two rather brief responses. And in fact, yeah. I opened the book with this encounter between Karl Barth on his visit to the United States in the 60s and Carl Henry, who was covering Barth's appearance in Washington, D.C. in his capacity as an editor at Christianity Today. And essentially, they get into this fight over what it means to say that the miracles of the Bible really happened. You know, I think Henry asks, you know, if Christ's resurrection happened today, would all these reporters who are here now, would they cover it as news? And, you know, essentially the Barth and the room full of journalists burst out laughing because the question seems so absurd. And, you know, Barth shoots back, you know, did you say you were from Christianity Today or Christianity Yesterday? You know, and I always wondered, you know, if I would have loved the chance to, you know, read or talk to Barth while he was alive about that encounter. I have the suspicion that he probably barely remembered it. I bet it didn't really, I doubt that it fixed in his mind. But for Carl Henry, who recounted this incident in his memoir at great length, it was clearly this sort of defining moment. And he really felt that he, you know, when he shot back in his retort, you know, Christianity yesterday, today, and forever, you know, that's what I stand for. He really felt that he got the better of Barth. But and at some level, I think that the neo-evangelicals had this hope that maybe in some way Karl Barth and other theologians who are typically classed as neo-Orthodox thinkers mm-hmm. were somehow potential allies in the battle against pagan modernity. Because the neo-Orthodox theologians, as that name implies, while many issues divided people like Emil Brunner and Reinhold Niebuhr from Karl Barth, these guys did not agree on everything. Mm-hmm. They did share a common critique of liberal Protestantism and its undue optimism about human nature, its claims about God's immanence at the expense of a sense of God's distance and awesomeness from our human existence. And so even though these guys were not believers in an inerrant Bible by any stretch of the imagination, there is a way in which they both saw that there were problems with kind of secular modernity. Now, C.S. Lewis. I got interested in Lewis as I observed, not just in my historical work, but in my capacity as a journalist, what a lasting hold he still has on American evangelicals. And so I was really interested to sort of get to the bottom of that. And I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in the archives at Wheaton College, which has a center devoted to Lewis and some of his friends, the Marion Wade Center, and has a lot of related papers, and also has the papers of a particular professor of English there named Clyde Kilby. Now, he's not someone that anyone, you know, outside of a handful of specialists really have heard of, unless you're, you know, in certain evangelical circles. But I found that he was tremendously important for teasing out this other way of kind of speaking back to the Carl Henrys of the world, certainly speaking back to the Jerry Falwells of the world. Clyde Kilby was teaching at Wheaton in the middle of the 20th century. He was teaching at a place that was still very aware of its fundamentalist heritage, but was more ecumenical, had a wider range of students coming to it than, you know, a place like Bob Jones or one of these other more fundamentalist institutions. And I think that Kilby was also very aware that many of his students were growing up in families, coming out of contexts in which art and fiction, literature, were all considered a bit suspect. They didn't have a clear didactic purpose. Often, you know, they could be vessels of dangerous modern ideas. They weren't something that these students grew up with. And Kilby thought this was a great shame, that his students had this very pinched understanding of the incarnation, frankly, you know, God's work in the world and the way in which all of these aspects of our culture can carry some spark of the divine. And C.S. Lewis, he struck up a correspondence with C.S. Lewis, and he taught a number of courses focused on the work of Lewis, as well as J.R.R. Tolkien, who was Catholic. And the works of these two authors became sort of gateway drugs for his students. The thing about C.S. Lewis is that he lays his theological cards on the table. And, you know, he wrote loads of apologetic work that makes his commitment to Christian orthodoxy very clear before he embarked on his really, you know, equally well-known fiction career in his fantasy writing. And so C.S. Lewis was not seen as so dangerous. You know, we know he's a Christian, and for crying out loud, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia are this very obvious, you know, allegory. And likewise, you know, Tolkien was, you know, yes, Catholic, but known as Christian. And so these were safe books, and they opened up a whole world of literature and artistic appreciation. And one of my favorite discoveries in the archives was this folder of letters. They weren't actually letters addressed to Kilby. They were really more course evaluations addressed to the department about Kilby's courses. And these students just went on rapturously about the way the course had changed their view of Christianity and the sort of richness of their own tradition. And I came to think of this commitment that Kilby had to the power of the imagination as a really interesting lens for understanding evangelicalism more broadly, that can sometimes encompass political commitments and a kind of what scholars like to call sort of an imaginary, library of images and tropes and things that come out of the tradition, but can mean all kinds of other sort of broader things, and gave evangelicals who had some quarrel with the kind of emerging Christian right and its posture toward culture a broader way of thinking about their tradition and engaging with the wider world without necessarily sacrificing their own commitments.
Now, the other major aspect of evangelicalism that you talk about following the discussion of higher education is evangelism movements. So Graham is obviously there, but you talk about other figures who are key in really helping to bring together and create a unified sense of what evangelism was. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of evangelicalism that you wanted to engage alongside this kind of world of ideas in education?
Yeah, I tried to understand the position of my main subjects, who were all American, more or less, in an international context. And I came to see, as I traced the conversations they were having over the years, that they saw the need to both kind of come up with a conservative response to the liberal Protestant ecumenical movement that would create a platform for conversation and collaboration between conservative Protestants around the world, as well as, you know, this abiding ancient commitment to evangelism that morphs over time but remains important. And so I became particularly interested in the history of this massive international conference that happened for the first time in 1974, but there have been iterations of it every few years since then, called the Lausanne Conference. Billy Graham played a big role in that, as did the Anglican evangelist John Stott. And in many ways, it was quite dominated still by Western European and North American evangelicals, but they were at least by this point in 1974 quite aware of the need to promote the voices of conservative Protestants from the global South. And so in that context, there were really fascinating debates between Christians from Latin America and Asia and those from you know, the Western world over the priorities of the church. I mean, they could all agree on you know, the sort of basics of Christian doctrine on, you know, on the page, but in practice, you know, what does this mean for the church's commitment to social justice? You know, in what ways did you know, the particular context of American political history blind American evangelicals to the resonance of some of the social justice themes in the gospel in other parts of the world? At the same time, I found myself following the history of the greatest, in terms of scale, revival in the 20th century, one that is arguably still underway, and that is the Charismatic Renewal Movement, which is this explosion of what we would call Pentecostal-style worship practices and ideas that really starts in the 1950s in churches where prior to this, things like speaking in tongues or prophesying or claiming, you know, a power to heal, you know, with the aid of the Holy Spirit, physical injuries and illnesses, these ideas would have been totally verboten in you know, all Protestant communities, except for those that came out of the Pentecostal movement in the early 20th century. It's seen as until this time, a very marginal, somewhat embarrassing approach to Christian spirituality. But starting in the 50s, you start to see Lutherans in Minnesota and Anglican or Episcopalians in San Francisco having these experiences. And over the years, I mean, it starts to hit the Catholic community in the late 1960s. There's no strain of Christianity that's totally untouched by this this wave of revivals, really by the 1970s, and it proves divisive. I mean, in some cases it splits churches, but in other cases it builds amazing bridges. You know, so I found records of Cistercian monks, you know, going to a full gospel, you know, international men's right, fellowship, right. You know, and being embraced as long lost brothers, Catholic right. groups, you know, giving money to sponsor evangelical revivals. And this has massive implications for how American evangelicals understand the wider world, too, because this charismatic Pentecostal spiritual style is particularly successful in Africa and Latin America and in Asia. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it resonated with pre-Christian spiritual traditions that really saw a vibrant spiritual dimension to everyday reality and looked for the hand of God in every mundane detail of your life and hoped for the role of the spirit world and healing and things like this. So these American evangelicals who up to this point had really thought that, you know, these miracles, the tongues, all this stuff, you know, that was what the apostles did, but that was something God ordained only for that time and no more. They start getting these reports back from their own initially skeptical missionaries mm-hmm. saying, listen, I witnessed this healing, or I witnessed this revival in which thousands of people came to Jesus mm-hmm. and started speaking in tongues and fell on the ground. And at a certain point, these evangelicals can't dismiss this. And I think that the rise of the charismatic renewal movement and the way it reshapes every aspect of spirituality, from the music that you encounter, you know, in the average suburban megachurch, to the way people physically comport themselves in the pews, you know, maybe being, if not falling down in the aisle, then still a little more open to swaying, to closing their eyes and holding their hands up with their palms open to the sky and maybe speaking quietly under their breath. All of this, this enhanced physicality and openness to the Holy Spirit, number one, it creates a kind of common spiritual understanding that I think allowed evangelicals and Catholics to begin to see one another as part of the same faith, equally mm-hmm. pious. And it really creates this immense wellspring of fellow feeling and respect for Christians in the Global South, especially as Western evangelicals increasingly see their own culture as sliding inexorably toward secular paganism, and they see Africa and Latin America, you know, and Christianity's rise in China as the real hope for the future. And I think too, the charismatic renewal movement represents this enormous international kind of protest against the claims of modernity, mm-hmm. of, you know, modern science and technology and you know, social planning to solve all of our problems. And you know, it's part of this this ebb and flow that we see in, you know, the history of, I think, really all human civilizations, between religious enthusiasm and the reassertion of planning and reason. So in this regard, our era is not so different from centuries past. Mm-hmm.
So coming forward from there, you address so many interesting things toward the end of the book. When you're addressing what you call the varieties of American evangelicalism, which was taken from a title really nicely, you describe and engage with the variety of Bible translations and responses to the RSV, which was seen by evangelicals as too liberal. You talk a lot about how history is seen and used in American evangelicalism, with some really careful analysis of a couple of decades of the Southern Baptist Convention. And you talk about recent internal ways of approaching the history of evangelicalism, especially with Mark Knoll's work. You address Francis Schaeffer's work in the evangelical church. So there's so much packed into the end of this book. But why don't we finish with the way you discuss the evangelical left that arises in the 70s, what their influence was then, and how they've continued to be a presence in evangelicalism broadly conceived.
Yes, and I think this picks up some of the strands that we've been tracing earlier in this conversation, because activists like Jim Wallace, the evangelical writer Nancy Hardesty, and Ron Sider, who comes out of the Anabaptist tradition, these individuals in the 1970s all had some personal relationship with the more fundamentalist inclined communities of evangelicalism. Wallace himself grew up in a conservative Plymouth Brethren home in Michigan, but they made a very conscious effort to draw on some of these other historical strands that I've described to say very explicitly, evangelicalism is not just Billy Graham and the editorials of Christianity Today magazine. Evangelicalism is the Wesleyan tradition of, greater rights in the church for women and a kind of understanding of the progress that God intended us to make over time as a human community that allows for a different reading of some of Paul's prescriptions in the Bible. Evangelicalism is also the Anabaptist tradition, and its nonviolent witness and its critique of state power. And to simply cede the territory of evangelicalism to the loudest, most politically charged voices is to do a disservice to our tradition and to betray the great commitments of the gospel in our time, which these people all saw as the social justice challenges of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so Jim Wallis really tried to make a claim that the phrase the ethic of life is not one that should allude only or even primarily to the abortion question, but one that should call a Christian to defend life, very broadly speaking, to defend the dignity of poor people and the aged and other people on society's margins. And I think in the 70s, there was this dynamic uncertainty that is hard to understand from our own perspective when it seems like the sides of the culture war are so settled and kind of fixed. There was a lot of, I think, ambiguity on the politics of the fight over abortion. It wasn't such a partisan issue. You had many vocal Democrats who were pro-life, Republicans who thought that abortion should be legal. Certainly, most evangelical Protestants, until at least the late 1970s, saw abortion as really active protesting of abortion as very much a Catholic thing, not really a commitment they had. And there's this sorting that happens, this polarization on both sides. Maybe more so on the right, but also on the left. Abortion becomes this symbol of all legal abortion is the symbol of all that is wrong with the state of Western civilization. And a few key activists like Francis Schaeffer also persuade vast numbers of evangelicals that abortion is murder, and it is something that they really need to stand up against. And that, I mean, I think that really helps drive a wedge and discredit the efforts of people like Jim Wallis to rally numbers that could in any way rival the emerging moral majority. I mean, you see efforts along these lines. I mean, I followed the trail of evangelicals for McGovern, you know, their efforts to support McGovern's election.
Fascinating part of the book. I love that.
Yeah, fascinating. They didn't have too much success. A historian who's written about this in far greater length than I have, David Swartz, has traced the way in which the evangelical left was this complicated coalition of sort of progressive reformed thinkers and Anabaptists and Wesleyans and also women and Protestants of color and people who were not from the United States. And they benefit from their pluralism, but ultimately their pluralism does divide them. It's this common pattern in evangelical history, you know, this kind of spinning off and breakdown of communities along very complicated lines. However, I think that the evangelical left, I mean, it remains a potent voice in politics today, and I see as more and more millennial evangelicals become disillusioned with traditional, more conservative churches, particularly because of what they see as I think inhumane treatment of gay friends that they have, and a failure to really step up and witness the gospel on issues of racial justice. Mm-hmm. I think we'll start to see, if we're not already seeing, a kind of resurgence. There's a reason why, you know, the books of John Howard Yoder are still in print and still finding a small but dedicated and influential audience. And I by no means am forecasting the emergence of the evangelical left as the dominant face of conservative Protestantism. And I'm also not one of these people who thinks that the Christian right is dead or dying. Mm-hmm. I think it's still, even though its numbers do shrink a little bit every year, it's still a very powerful and dynamic force in our culture. It's going to be around for a very long time. But the evangelical left is not going away either.
Yeah. Well, Molly, thanks so much for joining us on New Books in Intellectual History. Before we go, can you tell us about what you might be working on now, what we could expect from you in the future?
Well, I continue to write about religion and politics in my capacity as journalist for the New York Times primarily. So I'm always working on an article related to that. At the moment, I'm working on a piece about the kind of difficult place that evangelical faculty and administrators and, you know, people who are part of the Christian college circuit find mm-hmm. themselves in mm-hmm. in our current political landscape in the context of the Trump movement. I have next year a audio and DVD course coming out with the teaching company on the the global history of Christianity since the Reformation. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really broad, fun project. And I'm just in the very beginning of a new book project, which I think will be a history of the idea of charisma in American history, both with the political and the religious valences of that term. So that's a broad project that will have a lot of evangelical history in it, but we'll stretch well beyond that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will keep our eyes out for that and follow you in the New York Times. Again, Molly, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.